everything we had pretty well went up in flames.
The Sockeye Fire burns dozens of structures near Willow. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 15th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, Alaskans try their hand at balancing the state budget.
Income tax?
No, absolutely not. We've been fine without it all these years, so I don't think, no.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Baby salmon live here, right in our backyards and neighborhoods. Go out, explore, and take the Baby Salmon Challenge. For more information, go to babysalmon.fish. This announcement is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The Sockeye Fire burning near Willow is still mapped at about 6,500 acres. Fire officials are expect the hot, windy weather to increase the size of the fire this evening. According to the state, as of last night, there were approximately 25 primary homes and 10 to 20 secondary structures destroyed on the north end of the fire. The Matanuska-Susitna Borough has a team that's assessing structure damage today to get a clearer indication of how many homes and structures were lost. Over 200 firefighters are on the ground trying to protect the homes and property that remain in the area from burning. Matsu Borough officials held a news conference this afternoon to update the public on their effort. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Casey Cook is the Matsu Borough Emergency Services Director. He calls the location of the fire very concerning in an area with both residences and businesses.
Today's fire weather is predicted to be hotter, drier, and windier than it was yesterday. So that's our major concern, is now we're fighting a large fire with poor fire behavior conditions.
Cook says with the evacuation complete, firefighters have turned their attention to protecting property in the area. Cook says it was a dry winter and a dry spring, and that means there's plenty of fuel for the fire.
The fire is moving fast. It's moving very hot. It's just ripping through the patches of black spruce, probably 20 or 30 miles an hour.
Cook and Matsu Borough Assemblyman Vern Halter surveyed the fire as it was advancing yesterday. Halter described driving down the park's highway as the fire raced above the road and roared in the ditches. He was choking up as he described the fire's impact.
I know of at least 12 to 15 houses that are lost. A lot of my friends, Dee Dee John Rowe and that whole neighborhood, I used to have a house there that's just leveled, really, tell you the truth. I think we moved 400 to 500 sled dogs in a matter of 2-3 hours.
Halter says Matsu Borough firefighters were able to save a lot of houses. Tom Kurth is the incident commander for the Sockeye Fire. He says the fire is consuming structures with some regularity, but not in large numbers at this point. He says wind is the primary enemy of the firefighting effort.
It's a fuels weather topography thing. So we're in flat land in a lot of that area, but a lot of that fuel is continuous. Any place you have that continuous black spruce, you know, that's a very fire-prone species. Gasoline on a stick for, you know, if you want for more spectacular language. But that stuff is carried, you know, it'll carry a fire.
On a more hopeful note, Kurth says part of the fire is burning toward Nancy Lakes, where it will encounter wetlands that might help slow its progress on that end. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Sockeye Fire outside of Willow is now the state's number one firefighting priority. Governor Bill Walker personally viewed the burned area by air today, while forestry officials are bringing in help from the Lower 48 and British Columbia. Meanwhile, about 50 people in a Houston shelter are waiting to find out if they can go home again. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Sunday's initial response to the Sockeye Fire has already cost the Matanuska-Susitna Borough $48,000. That was spent before midnight Sunday, according to Borough Manager John Moosey, who said today that the borough has requested a disaster declaration from the state. And Governor Bill Walker, fresh off a flyover of the fire area, said in Palmer,
I'm accepting it today. We'll use the step that's available to me to verbally say we accept this and make this a declaration of disaster.
There's no counting the cost of this fire, which is 0% contained. Some residents don't know if their homes survived the flames. During Sunday's hectic initial response to the fast-spreading fire, some neighborhoods closest to the blaze were voluntarily evacuated before the park's highway shut down. Willow's Frank Cross was one of the evacuees.
I saw the fire and I'm going, man, the wind is blowing 35 miles an hour. It's 5 miles north of me. I better go back and just kind of keep an eye on things. And I'm looking at this thing and I'm looking at it jump at a quarter mile intervals because of the wind. It flamed up behind Keshwitna Lake back on Sockeye, and it jumped a half a mile out by the road, then jumped over the road, and it jumped, looked like it's jumping, you know, a quarter to half a mile at a time. The wind is pushing the thing.
Cross spent the night in a Red Cross shelter hastily set up at Houston Middle School, as did Greg Hatfield, who made a run from the fire with his dog.
I just tied him up over there. I gotta go see if I can round up a dog bowl, something to water him with and feed him with. And
was it just you and your dog?
Yeah.
You had to get out?
Yeah. Everything we had pretty well went up in flames.
You think so? You know that for sure?
Yeah. We was one of the first ones. We seen the helicopter flying around us. Seen some smoke, but nothing we could do. We just got out of there. Had no idea. And then probably about a half hour later, I got officers hollering, get out of here, get out of here.
Gordon Bovey could see the fire 3 miles away from his home at mile 77 on the park's highway.
We were outside working and all of a sudden noticed a plume of smoke to the north. And so my wife actually called 911 and they had just dispatched the fire department. So from there, our day kind of turned. We realized pretty quickly it was headed our direction, so we started packing up our pets, and one of our neighbors is a firefighter, and so we had to pack up his 25 sled dogs as well for him. So we were busy packing up pets and a few household belongings, and shortly thereafter the troopers came through and asked us to leave.
Casey Cook, Borough Emergency Services Manager, has asked evacuees to wait at least until Tuesday to attempt returning home. Cook said Monday that the borough has started damage assessments in individual neighborhoods to determine whose homes are still standing. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
To see video of the evacuees and the Sockeye fire, you can go to alaskapublic.org. Two wild land fires were reported today, this afternoon, on the Kenai Peninsula. The larger one was called in at about 1:30 in the Sterling area. State Division of Forestry spokesperson Andy Alexandru says by 3 o'clock it had grown to 75 acres and was posing threats to homes.
We have retardant aircraft inbound to assist with the suppression action. We do have a helicopter there that we replaced our Kenai helicopter that went to Willow yesterday. We brought one up from Homer from Maritime Helicopters. It is on the Card Street fire right now.
There are no official numbers, but voluntary evacuations are underway as several hundred homes are located in the area. Personnel from the Kenai Peninsula Borough are responding on the ground. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, miners are forced to vacate a historic housing complex near Nome.
100 years ago, this beach had 30,000 people on it. In tents, much like the shacks that you see right now.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana and Tech, partners in the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood this summer. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
A new inquiry into the Alaska National Guard reaches many of the same conclusions as last year's federal investigation into the force. It finds that sexual assault and harassment claims were mishandled and calls for increased accountability and transparency to prevent future abuses. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
At a Monday morning press conference, the current Adjutant General Lori Hummel said what happened under her predecessor was unacceptable.
On behalf of the Guard, let me apologize to a number of individuals and Alaskans more broadly for this organization's mishandling of complaints about serious offenses and for betraying the confidence of people who only sought help and justice.
A new 93-page report confirms the Guard did have problems with its sexual assault reporting mechanisms and that leadership was not trusted to properly handle complaints. Patricia Collins, a retired Juneau judge who conducted the special investigation, told reporters that some of the causes were as mundane as not keeping proper paperwork.
When you don't maintain adequate records of what's being said to whom and when, you facilitate a culture that sort of feeds upon itself, where those persons that feel like they can bully or take advantage of others do, because there's no reporting of it.
Collins said that allowed a few members of the Guard to get away with particularly bad behavior. It also discouraged future victims from coming forward, meaning the number of sexual assaults is likely higher than documented. The report also looked at how law enforcement and the executive branch handled Guard complaints, going beyond the scope of the federal inquiry. Of the reports that were filed and ultimately sent to police, Collins' investigation found that law enforcement operated appropriately. She also concluded that the previous administration was aware of at least some of the problems with the Guard and could have addressed them in a more systematic manner. However, she says the response from the office of then-Governor Sean Parnell was characterized more by mismanagement than malice.
I did not find an overt cover-up. I did find a very unfortunate lack of information sharing between the National Guard and the governor's office, a lack of protocols that, at least in my view, should be in place to ensure better communications between those offices.
Going forward, Collins recommends that the National Guard be regularly surveyed on its command climate and that those results be made available to the governor, the legislature, and, when appropriate, the public. She also advised that two sexual assault cases be reopened, as well as a suspicious death. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Most budget estimates show all of the state's reserves will be used up by 2021, if not sooner. The solution? You decide. The governor is crowdsourcing possible answers through an interactive budget model that turns the problem into a game. KSKA's Ann Hillman asked random Anchorageites to take a stab at solving the crisis.
Diane Noreen is sitting in the Lusac Library lobby refining her resume. It includes everything from gold miner to North Slope worker to water sales rep. She puts it aside when I ask her to look at a convoluted spreadsheet that represents Alaska's financial future.
But so you can set how much you think oil is going to be in the future?
I see.
You can decide to do things.
Are you asking me to do that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Noreen looks skeptical, but quickly gets into it, clicking boxes that add in investment revenues and taxes, things that prevent the state from going broke in 6 years. Sales tax? Sure. Cigarette tax? Up it. She does have limits, though.
Income tax?
No, absolutely not. We've been fine without it all these years, so I don't think, no.
Noreen is trying to get the blazing red box at the top of the screen to turn green. With her host of changes, like new taxes and leveraging the permanent fund, she nudges it up to yellow.
Okay, now where are we?
So now, if you want to cut any departments.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Let's see, where do I start? I think we can start with the administration.
Across town, independent consultant Craig Zamatis has the exact same idea, but...
My brother works for the state, so I hope that doesn't impact his job.
Zamatis backs away from agency cuts because it could affect families and jobs. Upping taxes might cause people or businesses to leave the state, too, but none of those possible impacts were factored into the model. Zamatis focuses on revenue building instead, but he doesn't get very far.
We're having a hard time getting ourselves out of the red, even on paper, aren't we?
That's because things that seem drastic don't make that big of a difference. A 5% personal income tax only brings in about $210 million per year. A 5% sales tax adds another $860 million per year on average. The combination of options seems endless and incremental.
Well, the fiscal situation's pretty dire.
That's Larry Persily, former Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. He's been analyzing and writing about Alaska's fiscal situation for 40 years. Persily says the state has relied on oil revenues to bail it out of crises for decades, and it just won't work anymore.
No more IOUs to collect, no more windfall tax revenues coming in. What's there is there. It's running out. It is the day of reckoning. We've got to figure out how we're going to pay for services for the decades ahead, even for the years ahead, because those savings could be gone in a few years.
Persily says it will take big, controversial changes like broad-based taxes, using permanent fund earnings, and some budget cuts to keep the state functioning. The model, though too complex, illustrates the point well, and everyone I spoke with was willing to make at least some of the changes. But is it even politically possible? Persily says it has to be.
At some point, you're going to need elected officials to do what they think is right, even if the public's telling them, if you vote for that, I'm going to vote you out in the next election. It may come to that for some people. I'm sorry.
Back at the library, after half an hour, Noreen finishes the model. She's increased revenues by more than $40 billion over the next 15 years.
Hey, I'm bringing in money. I should run for office.
But it still isn't even close to enough money for the state to continue to function at current levels. The model is available online. The Department of Revenue plans to simplify it somewhat and link it to a survey. They'll use the results to shape the fiscal plan the administration will present to the legislature in the fall. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Lawmakers collected nearly $200,000 in per diem over the course of two special sessions, according to a preliminary tally by the legislature's accounting office. Per diem is meant to cover food and lodging expenses and is federally set. It was paid at a rate of $233 per day in Juneau and $295 in Anchorage. Lawmakers who did not live within driving distance of Anchorage were more likely to take per diem. Senator Donnie Olson, a Golovin Democrat who serves on the Finance Committee, was the top collector. He filed for 44 days, amounting to $11,000 in payment. Some members of leadership took per diem, even though they live within commuting distance of the LIO. Senate Rules Chair Charlie Huggins, a Wasilla Republican, received $6,000, with most of his per diem collected while in Anchorage. There were even some rank-and-file members who collected per diem while the legislature was meeting in their area. Senator Liesl McGuire collected more than $7,000 during the special sessions. However, the majority of Anchorage and Mat-Su legislators declined per diem during the second special session. As of last week, the total cost of the two special sessions, which were called to address the budget deficit, exceeded $500,000. You can find a list of how much each lawmaker took at alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN, dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
For decades, Nome's West Beach has served as an icon and home to the city's offshore mining community. Now, the historic encampment is shutting its doors and collapsing its tents for good. KNOM's Francesca Fenzi has more.
Today marks the final deadline to vacate one of Nome's more infamous housing projects.
If you're into indoor plumbing and if you're into nice hot showers after work every day and you're into not ever being cold, then living on West Beach is definitely not for you.
Ian Foster has lived in Nome for the past 6 years. He spent three of those living in one of the more comfortable-looking shelters on West Beach, a plywood cabin with propane heaters and two big picture windows. Foster has since upgraded to a place with actual running water, but says the cabin and its beachfront property, which he leases from Nome Gold Alaska, still holds a special place in his and Nome's history.
100 years ago, this beach had 30,000 people on it, in tents, much like the shacks that you see right now. You know, and now it's actually changing. Now it's actually coming to an end, this part of that current history that we were able to actually live and experience.
The impromptu mining camp has existed in one form or another for several decades, despite shifting land ownership and varying degrees of approval for would-be tenants. The current property owner, Noam Gold, officially opened the beach, along with another tract of land near the abandoned Dredge 6, for two-year leases in 2013.
Unfortunately, that area didn't work out very well because many reasons. Some of the people didn't behave very well. There were sanitation issues out there, trash, storage issues, pretty much turned in to a free-for-all.
Randy Powelson is Noam Gold's general manager. He says the company's decision not to renew those leases was threefold. First, the property was difficult to manage. A seasonal population and lack of identifiable house markers made distinguishing between leaseholders and squatters next to impossible. Second, he says, Noam Gold plans to make industrial use of the area for mining as early as 2017. And third, the beach shelters fall within the city's floodplain, a point that Nome City Manager Josie Banky says the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, was quick to make with city officials during its last inspection.
Basically, they were built kind of out of sight, out of mind. The folks constructing them didn't follow the city's building permit, floodplain permit. Obviously, it's a very vulnerable spot down the coast.
Banky says FEMA warned the city that semi-permanent structures on West Beach were a liability, and an order trickled down. Get rid of them. But for beach residents, that may be easier said than done. Foster says the camp on West Beach isn't simply historic. It provides a crucial alternative for miners too cash-strapped for Nome's expensive housing market.
I'm paying $1,000 a month for a little studio, and it's, you know, not that big, and it's not that fancy, and it's just a studio, and this isn't New York. Why am I paying $1,000 a month? It's just, that's what housing costs up here.
As for what a move closer to town will do for others in the mining community.
Well, hopefully it doesn't civilize us too much, you know. We're a wild bunch.
In Nome, I'm Francesca Fenzi.
Celebrating the first salmon of the season is a long and important tradition in Bristol Bay. Earlier this month, KDLG's Hannah Colton heard some boys had caught theirs on the beach and were going to take one to an elder. She followed along and came back with this story.
A text message from Robin Cheney told me her boys had caught three kings on the morning tide. They and their grandpa were going to make a delivery. Here's Tristan Cheney.
Yeah, we caught three this morning. Gave one to my mom, kept one, and then one to Ophi.
So why do you bring one to Ophi?
Because we always give some of what we catch to elders. And then if you give stuff to your elders, then you're going to catch more.
Hjalmar Ophi Olsen is an elder who's left a mark on Bristol Bay, as few have. He fished these waters for some 5 decades, starting as a kid in the sailboat days. He was a longtime director, CEO, and president of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, among other leadership roles. But he's retired from all that now. Ophi is in bad health. His kidneys are failing. And these days, it's tough for him to get too far from the house. He was sitting on the couch when the Cheney boys and his old friend Robin showed up with that 12-pound king.
Just sit tight, Ophi. The boys brought you a king salmon.
King salmon?
Yeah.
Where?
That one.
Oh, yeah, small one.
Small one. We caught it this morning.
Ah, wow.
He sized up the boys who brought him the fish, gave Robin a nod.
Okay.
Bye. Ophi, enjoy.
Yeah. Thank you, Robin.
You bet you.
Boy, that's going to be a treat and a half.
That evening, some old friends and fishermen came together to eat that fish with Ophi. They gathered around a humble table at Jerry Lieboff's house off Chuthmuck Road, named for Lieboff and his patchy clothes. Dave Bendinger grilled the fish for an hour on top of a cedar plank, and Ophi again asked for the recipe.
Pickles.
Put that thing on the plank.
45 minutes.
Yeah, wet it first. Let it cook maybe 10 minutes. Then flip it so it's charred. And then put the salmon on top, skin side down. Lid down, let it
Any good?
Oh, this is planks.
I'm going to bring you some planks.
Setnetter and Russian Orthodox priest Father Victor Nick stopped by for a bite and gave a blessing.
Okay, before we eat too much more, why don't you bless the meal?
May Christ our true God bless this food and drinks and assurance below, and has that prepared them for the Holy Ghost on the church of its. Amen.
Amen.
Okay.
You don't want no tarfak? You don't have to.
Maybe.
Ofi had said the fish was small, but there was plenty to go around. And it really was the best.
First King melts in your mouth.
Yeah.
It's like butter.
Lieboff asked Ofi about what it was like when the First Kings came in when he was a small kid.
That First King salmon was a big deal even then, right?
Oh, yeah.
Your mama and grandma, yeah. How'd they cook it for starting? Boil it or what?
Well, the head and the tail and the igyamchuk and the eggs. If it had eggs, they make chowder out of it. And out of the collars, and then you fry the steaks. You either fried or boiled. It was good. Nothing, every bit of the king salmon was used. Nothing left but the bones.
The whole bay is a cycle. The fish run out and back, tides come in and out, nets need mending year after year, and people gather around the table to tell stories and to fellowship around that first king salmon.
What I miss, Dave,
yeah,
is when I was small, young guy, even my first few years in high school, used to go with my dad and some older people, and say we went camping or something. Mm-hmm. And then when the light went out, you stay there and tell stories, listen to stories. Boy, interesting. Lots of stories, hunting stories, you know, stories about ghosts.
With a twinkle in his eye, Ofi had a captive audience, and we all kept nibbling on that fish for hours after it got cold. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Houston, Shaylin Cochran in Sterling, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Francesca Fenzi in Nome, Hannah Colton in Dillingham. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our engineer, audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.